I now have the pleasure of introducing today's trainers. They have all volunteered time over the years for many ITRC products, including developing and delivering this training. I'm going to turn this over to Sarah LaRoe from Anchor QEA to get us started.
Thanks so much, Taylor. So today we're going to be talking about some practical approaches for PFAS fate and transport evaluation. And today's training is going to basically present an overarching look at many aspects of PFAS fate and transport in the environment. But we're going to pr approach this a little differently this time than past trainings. And we're going to focus on PFAS fate and transport by framing what we know about PFAS in the context of a hypothetical scenario. And so this way, hopefully, it'll allow us to put everything we know into a framework that can be practically applied on real-world release sites. Next slide. And so the goal here is to synthesize the information provided throughout the PFAS-1 technical and regulatory document, which is available on the ITRC website, as well as prior trainings, in a way that it might be used in the field at a PFAS site. And so the topics that we're going to be talking about include a range of sections in the document that have been available for some time, as well as some newer information from the priority topics that came out this year. And so this training assumes that attendees are familiar with the content in our PFAS 101 trainings and maybe some of our PFAS Beyond the Basics trainings. Alternatively, attendees should have a lot of familiarity with the tech reg document or other PFAS literature. Next slide. And so this training will focus on the hypothetical scenario of an AFFF release, that's aqueous film-forming foam, it's a firefighting foam, release in a fire training area. And so much like the development of any site conceptual model, we'll work through these topics of source zone characterization, vadose zone, saturated zone, surface water transport, stormwater transport, and then finish up with some additional considerations for PFAS. And so, in each section, we're going to touch on the relevant fate and transport topics for PFAS and AFFF PFAS specifically. And this will include the available tools for PFAS fate and transport evaluation, like analytical and sampling considerations, as well as data interpretation. So, in total, the aim of the training is to understand how to evaluate what PFAS you have and where they're headed using this hypothetical scenario. One caveat here is that, in the interest of time, we're not going to comprehensively address all aspects of this hypothetical scenario, just the ones that are relevant to the intersection of PFAS chemistry and the chosen site characteristics. Next slide. So, our release scenario starts with Class B AFFF, which was used to extinguish hydrocarbon fuel fires and other high heat fires. And as such, its use was very widespread at airports, military facilities, and refineries. It was also used regularly in firefighter training to keep personnel prepared for emergency events. So, at these types of training locations, there's often a concrete pad on which the fuel fire is set, and sometimes a drainage system to take away the water, AFFF, and spent hydrocarbons from the pad. So, obviously, this scenario is a potential source for any number of contaminants that may have been used in this process, but the focus of training today is PFAS because, next slide. Because PFAS chemistry is unique. There are many ways in which the chemical structure of these molecules make them behave in a way that's not like other contaminants. And so, as such, we're going to focus on how the chemistry of PFAS make the dynamics of a site unique and dictate a different approach to everything from data collection to laboratory analytics to CSM development. And how we'll start is to review the details of this hypothetical scenario we have, and Alex is going to take over that for us.
Alex?
Alex, are you there?
I am here. I am very sorry. Make sure I turn off the mute button. I thank you, sir, for getting us going. I am here to present the case study to you. If you want to look at what we got going here, let's see. Okay, here we have an 8-acre facility. And this 8-acre facility for use for fire training using aqueous film-forming foam, as Sarah said, or otherwise known as AFFF. Is initially it was in a fairly remote area. The main feature of the facility is a large, shallow concrete basin in which burning oil is floated on top of water. Sometimes you might have a concrete structure or an aircraft frame, and that would be placed on the basin to be acted a target for that training. The facility is also used to test AFFF equipment as required to maintain readiness. The facility was closed in 1999, and during the approximately 30 years of operation, it used a wide variety of AFFF mixtures for that training. As the manufacture of AFFF evolved over time, different manufacturers, different formulations, and different manufacturing processes. After the facility was closed, a residential community was constructed, downgrading of the site between the facility and surface water. This community utilizes that groundwater for domestic and agricultural supply. Groundwater underneath the training area migrates beneath the new community, discharges in part to surface water. The surface water downstream from where the groundwater enters surface water is used as a municipal, an industrial, and agricultural water supply. So here we have a 3D view of the facility and the surrounding area. The light purple area represents the fire training area. You can see the basin in the middle. It is bordered by a concrete apron. You see a little gray line going around it. And that concrete apron was used to prevent the spread of fire outside the training area. Preliminary information indicates that PFAS had migrated through the vadozone zone to groundwater and moved the groundwater beneath the residential area. Here we're seeing it shown by a single house and a single well. For simplicity reasons. And that you can see it discharges to surface water. PFAS can also potentially reach surface water via stormwater runoff from the facility, as well as from windborne dust. Note that the residential well is completed in the PFAS plume. Initial sampling of the residential well water wells in the community found PFAS, so it was decided to place a point of use treatment on the wells to protect the residents. So this protection is being provided while the investigation is conducted and a final remedy option is selected and implemented. There's several potential human exposures to PFAS here. Use of the groundwater by the community for domestic and irrigation purposes, airborne dust from the training facility, use of the water body for municipal, industrial, and agricultural supply, recreational use of the lake, including gathering fish and shellfish. But here, in our training, we're not going to give you calculations for determining the degree of risk. And so, if you want more information on that regard, we have trainings in the Beyond the Basics and Ecological Effects trainings that we also provide. So, look to the ITRC and CLUIN websites to get through if you want that training. Now, we're going to move to a figure showing a cross section through the fire training area to surface water. You see the vadozone zone beneath the facility is about 20 feet in thick with a 5 foot fluctuation in the water table. This vadozone zone consists of a heterogeneous mixture of sands, silts, clays, and cobbles. Now you think of alluvial deposits. Here you can see the source area beneath the training facility, which has allowed PFAS to migrate to groundwater, creating a plume that discharges to the downgradient surface water. Other facts that are pertinent are the average annual recharge is 15 inches per year. And the closest water supply well to the community is approximately 300 feet down gradient. Now we move to aerial view of the training area and the immediate vicinity. You still see the PFAS plume in groundwater and the PFAS plume entering the surface water and residential community and supply well. Look closely at the fire training area. You see that there are a number of shapes within that training area. These represent different releases of AFFF over time. I wish there could be hundreds. Not all the releases to the ground occurred below the basin, as training could at time could cause the AFFF to be discharged outside of the basin. And in addition, remember I mentioned testing of AFFF equipment, that could lead to that discharges of AFFF being just placed directly onto the ground. So you think of trucks and pumps and making sure those are working correctly. Training included the use of fuels as a source of the fire. These fuels and the water used to float the fire on the basin cause additional issues that need to be investigated. Historically, some fire training facilities use other combustible materials such as spent solvents as a fuel for the fire, and that would modify the list of contaminants of concern, or COCs. So instead of just PFAS, the COCs now include fuel components, and combustible byproducts. One last thing here, stormwater falling on the facility, training facility flows across the facility towards surface water. There's a stormwater collection system located just to the right of the facility, conveying the stormwater to a lined, unlined drainage ditch, unlined and lined, because at times when it probably initially started, it was not lined, it eventually was lined, and that could also eventually have cracks in it and cause discharges to groundwater. So that basically that ditch transported the runoff to surface water, and the final segment of that pipeline is a concrete pipe. Oh, sorry, let me go. My bad. So this slide we're showing the goals of this case study. And not all are covered in this training. They will be focused on those shown in blue there. These goals and blues are those most affected by PFAS attributes and their impact on what fate and transport, sampling, and analysis. The list is not comprehensive, but represents many of the main goals in remedial investigation. The goals in black are achieved by the investigation process they should already be familiar with. There are numerous RAFS guidance documents that evaluate those goals. So there you have our case study. I am turning the training back over to Sarah to tell you about the source zone.
Thanks so much, Alex. Okay, so now that we know what kind of site we're dealing with, we're going to head to the first step in understanding the extent of the problem, and that's source zone characterization. Next slide. So the first complication here is that unfortunately there's no one definition of source area. So in general, the source area can be thought of as the area of contaminated media that continues to contribute mass to the PFAS groundwater plume. But there are different ways to go about getting a final delineation of the area. Some things to remember when you're doing this, though, is that A, there's a time component to this source area. It's basically resulted from a number of overlapping releases over many years, which can affect both the composition and the area that it occupies. And B, the extent of the source area occupies both the horizontal and the vertical plane, so it has this depth component over which composition may change as well. So, understanding these things, we have to build a sampling plan that'll allow us to fully delineate the extent of the source mass, understanding that in the end, the final delineation of the source area extent is subjective. It could depend on anything from mutually agreed upon concentration thresholds, maybe some PFAS profile markers that you see at the site, or maybe some simple visual observational definitions. So, next slide. So, as we're designing this sampling plan to understand the extent of the source area, we'll also need to keep in mind that understanding the composition of the source material is important. So, from our historical research so far, we know that the releases at this site were Class B AFFF, but it's also good to try to find out through historical record searches the manufacturer and date of the AFFF that was released. And this is because understanding source formulation will affect prediction of fate and transport and the downgradient fractionation of your PFAS mixture. So, Class B AFFF was historically created using PFAS made with either the ECF or fluorotelomer manufacturing processes. So, in general, 3M AFFF utilized PFAS made through ECF, while a variety of companies utilize PFAS made through fluorotelomerization. And the difference between these two processes is that ECF produces both PFCAs and PFSAs and precursors to both of those. But also, the isomeric composition is of both branched and linear isomers. In contrast, fluorotelomerization almost exclusively produces PFCAs and precursors to those PFCAs, and the isomeric composition is almost completely linear. And so, in addition to all of that, Class B AFFF formulations have been shown to differ between manufacturers and across time. So, those differences in manufacturer formulations are especially true with fluorotelomerization, since there are a few different manufacturers for that type of AFFF. But shown here on these pie charts, these represent select examples of AFFF compositions. They basically show the profile differences between manufacturing processes as well as over time. So the 3M ECF manufacturing formulations shown here on the left side, the two left pie charts. They show marked difference from the Ansel for telomerization manufacturing and formulation process shown on the right. But also the two 3F formulations are pretty different. The changes pretty considerably between the 1989 profile and the samples of foams made from 1993 to 2001. And so, as shown here, an understanding of the manufacturer and date of the Class B AFFF that was used to first establish, sorry, excuse me, that was used, it'll help you first establish if an AFFF product was manufactured using fluorotelomerization or ECF. And in some cases, you'll be able to get a full analytical profile of the AFFF formulation, similar to these pie charts, which could be available in the literature if you know your manufacturer and date. So, for more information about what's known about the specific AFFF products, you can see Table 3.1 in the PFAS1 document. Next slide. So, to go a step further in your CSM development, understanding the original formulation of the AFFF released at your site can help you predict the likely future composition of the PFAS downgradient of the source zone. So, environmental transformation of precursors into terminal PFAAs is a body of research that's been growing in recent years. This has helped our understanding of both the degradation pathways that can occur as well as the rates that they occur. And when we look at the change in PFAS composition, what we can say most generally is that there tends to be a group of precursors that will most likely terminate as PFCAs and a group of precursors that will most likely terminate as PFSAs. And this general rule of thumb will help you understand the relationship between the upgradient and downgradient profiles at your site. And also, when we look at transport potential, many precursors have a higher sorptive capacity than the terminal PFAAs that they turn into. So, the transport capacity of a PFAS mixture at the time of release is likely much different than the transport capacity after environmental transformation has occurred. So, this change in composition through transformation has a number of implications in your CSM. And for more information on this, we have Table 4.1 in the PFAS1 document, which has compiled many relevant published transformation rates. Next slide. So we'll use all of this information as we think about the design of a sampling plan to define your source zone. So, like in all site characterizations, you'll need to choose the locations and depths of your samples, as well as the analytical methods used to determine the PFAS that are present. So samples can be taken around the concrete pad and apron. Depth profiles in that concrete may be needed to understand the extent of infiltration into the concrete. These results can help with later practical decisions too, like disposal options if and when that concrete is excavated. Also, you can do soil borings around the outside of the apron or beneath the concrete to understand the vertical soil profile. And lastly, you can take samples of drainage sediment and concrete from the surrounding drainage system. And once you decide on the placement of your samples, you need to choose the analytical methods that can help understand source characteristics if your historical information is unavailable, or it could help you confirm the historical records that you do have. More specifically, your choice of lab method can help you get a full profile of the PFAS in your source zone, which can get you an idea of the magnitude of the releases, with or without utilizing a full mass estimate. So, the standard EPA method, 1633A, which is a target analysis method, that can and should be used first. But you need to understand that the analyte list for 1633A will mainly tell you the concentrations of PFAAs and some select precursors. So, if you want to understand better the magnitude of the precursors in your source zone, you have the option to employ other analytical methods. So you could ask for target analysis of different compounds that are not on the 1633A list, and that's definitely a possibility. If you want to cast a wider net, you could choose to do a non-target analysis, which can individually identify any number of PFAS precursors. But the limitation on that is that you won't get quantitative results. You could also utilize TOF and TOF, which are methods that can tell you lump sum concentration of either precursors that directly transform to PFAAs in the case of TOF, or any compound with organic fluorine in it in the case of TOF. So all of these alternate methods aren't routinely done, but in the case of source zone sampling, you might want to go beyond the standard EPA method to gain understanding of your source profile. And this information can help with a number of things. It can help you predict the future risk at the site. It can help inform source control design, and it can inform downgradient sampling placement and analytical methods. So, next slide. And so we'll stop here for a quick knowledge check on the A on AFFF source material. So the question is, AFFF composition can vary due to A, the manufacturing process that produced the PFAS, B, the AFFF supplier that produced the formulation, C, when the AFFF supplier produced that formulation, or D, all of the above. All right, 96%. Great job, guys. So, good knowledge check there. Now that we've now that we've defined our source zone, we're gonna head down to the next down gradient compartment and talk about what happens in the vadose zone with Dina.
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, you sound good, Dina. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Okay. So, the objective of sampling the vadose zone that underlies the source zone is to define source strength and the potential for continued mass release. And really, this is the first environmental compartment that your mass encounters, and thus it kind of has downstream implications for the rest of the PFAS masses' fate and transport. So, with that, let's just jump into some of the PFAS specific considerations in the vadose zone. Can we get the next slide, please? Thank you. So, there are certain behaviors that are specific to PFAS chemistry that inform and have implications for source strength evaluation. And largely, these are going to be surfactant driven. And that in particular has to do with the air-water interfacial retention. PFAS surfactant behavior in terms of air-water interfacial retention is amplified relative to like hydrocarbon surfactants due to the polarizability of that carbon-fluorine bond. So this translates to even greater adherence to interfaces, and this is emphasized more for your long-chain sulfonates, specifically like your PFOS relative to your PFBA. So even within surfactants, we have this differentiation of surfactant adherence to interfaces based on the chemistry of your compound of concern. And then PFAS also have some unique interactions with respect to soil chemistry. And perhaps the most important thing to underscore here as we get into our source strength evaluation is that organic carbon only tells a part of the story. And other things such as PFAS or pH can indirectly, in fact, impact PFAS sorption by altering mineral surface charges. Again, we have that sorption to the air-water interface, not just organic carbon. The presence of divalent cations in your system can also influence PFAS sorption, as well as remedial history. Something like ISCO could impact your soil chemistry and therefore impact your PFAS retention there. And so really, this comes down to the dilution attenuation factor assumes linear instantaneous absorption that's only influenced by organic carbon. And so soil screening limits based on those assumptions alone doesn't really account for all these other retentive properties that are inherent to PFAS and other surfactants. And so therefore, those might be overly conservative. We're going to move over here to the right side of the slide, which kind of depicts how these behaviors manifest through the vadose zone, from like the shallow vadose zone, where you have a lot of air water interfacial area, to deeper down as we approach the water table, and that air water interfacial area either diminishes significantly or collapses completely. So, in our shallow vadose zone, or following an extended period of arid conditions, there's plenty of air water interface for PFAS to absorb to. So you can get PFOS absorbing to the air water interface just as readily as something like PFBA. But again, this is a preferential absorption by our long chain compounds. So deeper in the vadose zone, or transiently during recharge events where you have a little less air water interfacial area, that absorption becomes competitive. So the long chain sulfonates will still adhere to that interface, and the short chains kind of get bumped into the bulk solution and therefore might elute quicker. And then as we approach the water table, or during like brief periods of full saturation during a focused recharge event, there's complete air water interfacial collapse. And then you get a pulse of mass release. And much of this is associated with colloids. So very small, I think it's 0.45 microns or less. The PFAS will adhere to those colloid particles, and those pulse down during these recharge events, resulting in kind of a pulse of mass to your water table. And then with that, can I get the next slide, please? So with all of the complexities of PFAS storage and release from the vadose zone that we just kind of went through, it's beneficial to evaluate soil strength using a lot of tools. And on the left side here, we have a graphic that exhibits how if our PFAS is this red shadow around some of our soil grains and selectively in some of our pore water, you could see how the transience and hysteric nature might influence concentrations observed in pore water. And that translates to a lot of complexities when it comes to collecting a representative leachate sample or a representative pore water sample. And this is further complicated along because with determining a soil concentration that's protective of groundwater, it's also important to determine how persistent the source is expected to be. And in our example, we have one source, but in an area where you have multiple sources, you may need to prioritize resources to address them. And so moving over to the right side of the slide here, these are some of the tools that are at practitioners' disposal to disambiguate source strength in the vadose zone. So we have lysimeters, laboratory leaching tests, that's going to be inclusive of SPLP and various leach methods. Lysimeters, we have suction cup lysimeters are what are traditionally used, but there are also drain gauge lysimeters that can they're designed to collect both pore water samples for analysis and to quantify how much recharge there actually is in the area. And then finally, I have predictive modeling here, and some examples of that are PFAS leach out of University of Arizona, and there are various Hydrus 1D applications. And really, these are powerful for ingesting field observations into screening level decision making. And so using lysimeters and laboratory leaching tests together, I'll show you here shortly with our example site, how you can build a soil screening limit that's still reflective of source area conditions, even though we're using DAF assumptions. Also, these kind of empirical-based tools from lysimeters and laboratory leaching tests can be used to gain insight into inputs that could go into predictive models. For example, you could use your SPLP or your LEAF method to determine a field representative KD that you can put into your predictive model as sort of a benchmark. Lysimeters, I know specifically for PFAS leach, pore water concentrations are used in a scaling factor for determining surface roughness and therefore an estimation of air water interfacial area, which is pretty difficult to measure directly. So, for the examples, I will go through how specific data from lysimeters and leaching tests can be used to develop site-specific soil screening limits, and how these two data sets are complementary, and also some cautions that should be observed for each. And with that, can I get the next slide, please? Thank you. So, like I said, we're going to use lysimeters and leaching tests, but each kind of has their own nuances with respect to PFAS that need to be understood. And this is not meant to be exhaustive, but it's specific to PFAS as a contaminant and a concern. So, starting with leaching tests, these really have the potential to overestimate pore water concentrations, particularly for those long-chain PFAS compounds like PFOS, because you're completely destroying the air-water interface if you do a full saturation test. For example, like SPLP, you do a 20-to-1 dilution. That's not representative of what you would observe in the environment for a vadosone. Is you're not going to observe full saturation for extended periods of time. But on the other hand, they're very repeatable, and you're likely to get the same answer from the same soil multiple times. And so that lends itself very well for developing distribution coefficients. So very useful for the distribution coefficient aspect. On the other side, we have lysimeters, and it's important to note that these really do represent a snapshot and probably require seasonal samples to capture the full spectrum of leaching behavior, since your pore water concentrations are going to vary based on soil moisture for the reasons we discussed earlier, right? If you have very low soil moisture, you'll probably expect to pull higher concentrations just based on all of that area that is available for your PFAS to sorb to. And then, finally, like we have leaching tests that are standardized, lysimeter samples that are going to be field relevant, and neither is perfect on their own, but together, they kind of bracket reality much better than just measuring your soil concentrations on their own. I guess, and then with that, it should be noted that it's extremely important if you're doing a leaching test or a lysimeter test or both, that you take a co-located soil sample to collect total PFAS from. It's very difficult to interpret leachate or pore water data absent co-located soil concentration data. And I think with that, we can move on to how we're going to instrument our example site here. So at the example site, we have sufficient depth to groundwater, and we have climate and lithology that are both conducive to lysimetry. It's not going to be overly arid where we're going to have a hard time pulling pore water. We have enough precipitation where we expect to catch that recharge front, and the groundwater is deep enough where we're getting a zero flux plane. We are able to collect pore water that isn't just groundwater, right? And so when it comes to the installation strategy here, what matters more than just like the number of lysimeters that are placed is the range of depths, permeabilities, and the concentrations that we observe are represented in our lysimeter and leaching test execution. So coincident with the lysimeter cups, soil samples again would be collected and analyzed for total PFAS, and they would also splits can be sent for laboratory leaching tests. In this case, I'm referencing SPLP for our example site, but again, you could use something like LEAF to get at kind of a kinetic desorption if you use the time step one. And yeah, so additional characterization can also be performed on those co-located soil samples. We're not going to go into how this would support model development in detail, but you could characterize those for FOC, mineral content, cation exchange capacity, and various other soil characteristics that could influence PFAS sorption specifically. And then those can go into the predictive model to kind of more tightly bind what you expect your soil screening limit to be. And then I think one more click and one more click. Sorry. So again, it's not just a lysimeter count or a leaching test count. It's really representing the depths, the permeabilities, and the concentrations in your Vado zone with these samples. So, how we are going to use this data is in the next slide. Great. So don't it's I know it's a lot, but how we're going to use the data from our lysimeters and our SPLP and total PFAS in soil to derive a site-specific soil screening limit is kind of explained here. So equations 1 through 3 over on the left, these should be, pretty familiar to most of you. That first one just defines a pore water concentration protective of groundwater. So that's your PWPGW term. And that's going to be your whatever project screening limit is appropriate. This is something that you would agree on in practice with regulators ahead of execution here. And then the DAF is the representing the dilution attenuation factor equation, and this is the one in equation 2 and really 3 as well, from the EPA. And a lot of this information you'll notice you can in that orange box there can be gained from just really good understanding of your conceptual site model. And a lot of it can be accessed from the desktop. This was kept kind of ambiguous so that it could be used, going forward. But all of these should be accessible to practitioners. And then, so while this is site specific, the next question is how do we build in some of that PFAS-specific retentive properties that we discussed earlier? And this is where the empirical relationships between soil and leachate data can resolve that relationship. So here you have the leachate and the soil concentrations from both SPLP and lysimetry regressed, and this is where equation 4 is that fitted relationship in log space between soil concentration and leachate concentration. And log space is used here because these relationships can span orders of magnitude. And so really the slope here is going to capture how strongly the leachate concentration responds to our increasing soil concentration. And the intercept reflects a baseline offset, and this is introduced by partitioning and the test method itself. And then equation 5 just inverts that empirical relationship and solves for a soil concentration that le yields the pore water concentration determined that was previously determined to be protective of groundwater from equation 1. And so with that, you can develop a soil screening limit that is encompassing all of the aspects of PFAS retention that you would observe in the field from your lysimeter data and perhaps your worst case scenario or your most conservative set of data from your SPLP and then deriving the soil screening limit. And then with that, I'll take it to the next slide, please. Great. So this is a knowledge check. And so, would you expect a PFOS soil screening limit derived from SPLP to be higher than a soil screening limit derived from lysimeter war pore water? Why would you expect that to be?
Thanks, Dina. I'm going to give it just maybe 10 or 15 more seconds as responses come in.
Great.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and close it and share the results.
Great job. So yeah, A is the answer, and it's so recall that SPLP is going to fully saturate the soil, and so you lose that air water interface completely. So any of the PFOS that would have been retained at that air water interface is now in solution. So what you would sample from SPLP versus pore water is going to be enriched with relative to PFOS. So good job.
All right, thank you, Dina. We've now reached our first Q&A break of the training, and I do have a couple questions for each of our trainers that presented in the first half of today's training. And I'll start with a question for Alex. For the hypothetical case study, the area labeled fire training area and basin, are these areas concrete at land surface? Are the other areas of the former facility open soil or grass?
Good question. The if you look at the fire, the basin itself, it's concrete at the surface. It probably extends down a few feet to be able to have a sturdy enough structure to last for a considerable period of time. Think of rebar and that sort of thing. The perimeter boundary concrete apron is also at the land surface. In between the within the fire training area, the rest of the material is just soil and probably grasses, that sort of thing. No trees, nothing like that. So it's fairly an open, a pretty open facility.
All right, thank you, Alex. Now I have a couple questions for Sarah. Can you remind us what is a precursor PFAS and how are they different from the PFCAs and PFSAs?
Sure. Precursor PFAS, as a reminder, are the group of PFAS that eventually can transform to PFAAs, and PFAAs are terminal compounds. And PFCAs and PFSAs are subgroups of those PFAAs. The PFCAs have a carboxylate head group, while the PFSAs have a sulfonate head group. That's all reviewed in the new PFAS chemistry training that has recently come out.
Thank you, Sarah. And one more question for you. For source zone sampling, should US EPA method 1633A be used to analyze soil, sediment, and groundwater samples? Is there information about sampling and analyzing concrete?
Yeah, so for that first question, 1633A should definitely be used as your first analytical method that you want to use just to find out what you have there as the standard method for all of those matrices. Like I said, it'll definitely give you the list of PFAAs and some precursors, but it might not give you the whole picture. So that's why I was saying a little bit, there are a number of alternate analytical methods that you can use to kind of understand the magnitude of the precursors that you might have, especially at an AFFF site. Sampling and analyzing concrete, that's definitely a newer topic of research, and there's actually a new section in our priority topics. I think it's 1.5. that talks about sampling of concrete and asphalt. And there's also a couple of CERTA ESTCP projects for managing PFAS impacted concrete that are just coming out now.
Great. Thank you, Sarah, for that information. And then I have one question for the section on Betazone, and I will be asking this to Robert, who is one of our subject matter experts in the background. For PFAS behavior in the Betazone, would you define colloidal transport? I hope I said that correctly.
Sure. Yeah. So colloidal transport is of PFAS is what would happen if PFAS are sorbed to mobile colloids in the subsurface, whether that's vadose zone or saturated zone. So there are often small particles that are able to move with groundwater, and depending on the characteristics of the aquifer, you might have PFAS sorbed to those particulates or colloids, which then can be transported through normal colloid transport mechanisms along with any water that's leaching through that betazone zone or in the saturated zone moving with groundwater.
Great. Thank you, Robert. And Dina, I did see you come off of mute. Did you want to answer another question from your section?
No, Robert did a great job.
Okay, great. All right, thank you all. And in the interest of time, I will now be moving on with the training to the next section. Thank you all for your questions and for you interact with that Q&A pod that will be open for the rest of the training, and we will have one more opportunity for a live Q&A at the end. And I will now pass it off to Matt from Leidos to continue with the saturated zone.
All right, thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Dina. Now we're moving on to PFAS fate and transport in the saturated zone. We'll move on to the next slide, please. All right, so in the saturated zone, several of the unique PFAS behaviors that were mentioned previously will still apply. Here we've listed some of the primary behaviors to consider for fate and transport. Also listed are the relevant sections from the ITRC guidance document for your future reference. First bullet, co-contaminants pose challenges for PFAS in the saturated zone. The type of co-contaminant and its concentration will determine both the type and magnitude of effect that it will have on PFAS fate and transport. In our example scenario, petroleum hydrocarbons are present. They may be present in NAPL form. PFAS have an affinity for interfaces, so that will include the air-water interface, but also the air-NAPL interface and the NAPL-water interfaces. Additionally, something to consider is that PFAS may dissolve into the NAPL as well as into the water. So co-contaminants can also affect PFAS partitioning due to factors such as like ionic strength or competition for organic carbon. The impact of the co-contaminants will vary based on the contaminant and the individual PFAS compound. So for instance, fluoroelastomer alcohol may be more likely to partition to a NAPL than to accumulate at the interface, but this tendency would be different from a compound like PFOA. So each of these behaviors may be compound specific. Studies also indicate that PFAS accumulation at the NAPL air and NAPL water interface is going to be lower than what you would see at the air water interface. So it'll still have an impact, but it'll be lower. Another consideration is that NAPLs are unique blends of compounds with their own fate and transport factors. So in this scenario or scenario where you have NAPL present, the fate and transport of PFAS will be tied to the NAPL fate and transport. Precursor transformation is another thing to consider that still occurs in the saturated zone. It'll be most likely occur at a less significant extent than it would in the vadose zone. The degree of transformation is going to be influenced by the oxidative state of the aquifer, and the potential for transformation will vary both spatially and temporally as the geochemistry varies. Back diffusion or diffusion, matrix diffusion may occur in the saturated zone, and some studies indicate that the effects can be more significant for PFAS than for chlorinated solvents. And since back diffusion has been a notorious problem for chlorinated solvents, it's important to note that it could be even more challenging factor for PFAS. The transient levels of unconfined aquifer, such as in the example scenario, will experience continually fluctuating groundwater levels. This fluctuation will impact the location of the air water interface and the NAPL interface, and it also change the affect the capillary fringe, all of which will affect the phaeton transport. The zone where the water levels are is fluctuating. It could be an area where PFAS may be retained, but the amount of infiltration that's occurring, the rate, and the change in water level will be heavily affect PFAS retention. And then this effect will also be influenced by the soil types, which will influence the thickness of the capillary fringe and related forces that affect migration. Last bullet, we have differential migration. Now, this isn't something that's unique to PFAS, but the mechanisms and the rates and impacts for PFAS are noteworthy. So differential migration, also called fractionation, occurs when the composition of a plume changes along its flow path. So instead of the mix of PFAS compounds remaining the same across the plume extent, it changes. So some compounds may increase in their relative percent concentration and others may decrease. This fractionation is produced by a variety of factors such as differential migration rates or precursor transformation, the aquifer geochemistry, or differing amounts of attenuation that's experienced along the groundwater flow path. Let's see, let's go to the next slide. So this slide illustrates the concept of differential migration and also some of the impacts of co-contaminants. The presence of co-contaminants will affect the aquifer geochemistry. Often it can reduce the oxidation reduction potential or the ORP and create anoxic reducing conditions. But with increasing distance from the source area, the ORP would increase, indicating a greater potential for oxidation to occur. As the ORP increases, so does the potential for precursor transformation. I guess the fundamental point there is that the geochemistry can impact the composition of PFAS plumes, both spatially and temporally through time. The plume composition is also impacted by differing migration rates for each PFAS compound. So each compound is going to have its own rate that it migrates due to various properties. Slower migrating compounds will become enriched near the source area, and faster migrating compounds will be enriched in distal portions of the plume. In general, longer chain perfluorosulfonates might migrate slower than their shorter chain counterparts or shorter chain carboxylates. And then in this figure, we have some radar diagrams. These are one tool that we can use to evaluate plume composition. In our hypothetical depiction, the radar diagrams show the relative proportions of PFNA, a long chain carboxylate, PFOS, a long chain sulfonate, PFHXA, a mid-chain carboxylate, and 8,2-FTS, a fluorotelomer sulfonate that is also a potential precursor for carboxylates such as PFHXA. So going back to the illustration there, as we move away from the source in the downgradient direction, we might expect the relative abundance of 8,2-FTS to decrease due to transformation processes as this precursor may transform. As this occur, the end products of that transformation may increase. So you may see an increase of something like PFHXA. We might also expect to see a decrease in the contribution of PFOS, not because of transformation, but due to higher sorption in the aquifer matrix. Additionally, something to notice is the presence of NAPL in the source area is going to lower the ORP, which may decrease the potential for oxidation or precursor oxidation. But as we move away from the source area, the ORP is depicted as rising, and so does the potential for transformation by oxidation. Let's see, let's go to the next slide. So, as far as a plan for sampling the saturated zone, it's essential to begin with some reminders. Sampling for PFAS requires very strict adherence to standard operating procedures. There's a lot of summary in the ITRC's guidance, particularly in section 11. With respect to groundwater sampling and investigations, I wanted to highlight just a couple notes. First, the coated bentonite pellets have been shown to contain PFAS in some cases, so they should either be avoided or tested in advance. It's also common for drilling equipment to have lubricants that may contain PFAS. So oftentimes this may be something like PTFE, known as Teflon. So you want to make sure you're avoiding anything like that so that you're collecting representative samples. Something else to note is that some concrete blends may contain PFAS, so you need to scrutinize that when constructing monitoring wells. And then also always confirm that your drilling, sampling, decon procedures are using water that meets your project data quality objectives for PFAS-free. And then lastly, minimizing turbidity. So use proper well construction, well development, and sampling protocols to make sure that you're sampling representative of the groundwater and not mixing in turbidity. Next slide. For PFAS fate and transport, a fundamental goal is to understand the plume characteristics and the dynamics in the context of the site's hydrogeology. So PFAS pose a lot of challenges, but despite the complexities, understanding the fate and transport of PFAS still requires the fundamental characterization of the site's hydrogeology. So this would include things like understanding the geochemistry, the soil properties, the hydraulic properties, and characterization of details like grain size, hydraulic conductivity, or organic carbon and ORP, all of which is similar to evaluations you do for other contaminants. It could be helpful to characterize your site using techniques such as environmental sequence stratigraphy or geomorphology, geologic history to develop your site conceptual model. It may also be warranted to use site-specific methods to collect hydrogeologic data like pump tests or slug tests. Your sampling plan may also want to consider the use of high-resolution site characterization tools where it's appropriate. For example scenario, it might be a great candidate for something like direct push technology with tooling such as hydraulic profiling tools or aquifer profiling systems that enable you to get rapid lithologic and hydrologic data. And you could also consider things like surface or borehole geophysics or remote sensing tools to help you with your characterization. Overall, conceptually, your sampling plan should seek to characterize both the source area and the distal extents, and the plan should also assess the stability of the PFAS plume to understand whether it's shrinking or growing. And at some sites, it may be beneficial to view that in the framework of a mass flux estimate. In the example scenario, we propose using a series of longitudinal and transverse transects along the flow path from the source area to downgradient area, and then collecting data across multiple events to assess changes over time and seasons. A sampling plan should evaluate precursor transformation and also look at the impact of co-contaminants. So using the transects that we talked about and we'll show in another slide will help with this evaluation. We can also use additional analytical methods to help with the evaluation, such as the total oxidizer precursor assay or total fluorine or non-target analyses that Sarah referred to earlier. Lastly, detailed consideration should be given to the impact of NAPL to understand how it may be impeding or affecting PFAS migration. So your sampling strategies could consider things like discrete interval sampling or targeting the NAPL interface, sampling the NAPL itself to understand the concentrations dissolved in it. Additional information for all these topics are presented in the relevant sections noted there. Next slide, please. Okay, so in this figure, we present our general concept for characterizing the saturated zone. Previously, we talked about plans for characterizing the source area, so the intent here is more to talk about the overall characterization of the site. The general strategy is to use a series of transects that are oriented perpendicular to the flow direction. as well as some background points and additional source area sampling. This network conceptually would be sampled multiple times to understand migration and seasonal variations. And then it's important to note that this monitoring or characterization configuration is more of a generic final configuration. In practice, you wouldn't know the length or the width, the depth of the plume, and you need to determine that. Oftentimes, this could be done through a phased approach using step-in and step-out samples. You could use techniques like high-resolution site characterization or vertical aquifer profiling and temporary wells or permanent wells and a mix of all those to help define the bounds of your plume. But the general idea is to rely on your conceptual site model to identify where you want to sample, where data gaps are, and then as new data become available, you'd refine your CSM and identify new data gaps and new sampling points. In this manner, you'd add additional points until the plume extents are determined within your project objectives. In practice, actual sites have a good varying degree of heterogeneity that may control plume migration. So your sampling plans really need to be tailored to your site and your CSM, and they should account for the variability of the aquifer materials. Next slide. All right, so now we're building on the previous slide. Here we're showing the conceptual monitoring network in a cross-sectional view. This is intended to represent a transect along the core of the plume. And let's see. Here we show two different depths for the sampling locations where the aquifer is about 20 to 40 feet thick and depicted as roughly homogeneous material. But for sites with thicker aquifers, you may need additional wells at different depths, or for highly variable matrices, you may need additional wells. So your characterization ahead of this is be very important to determine how many depths and locations you need. Vertical delineation can be really important for PFAS because diffusion, dispersion, and the unique surfactant properties may or may not result in downward migration. Your site-specific hydrogeology and local water usage, such as pumping or withdrawals, may also result in downward gradients. So it's important to understand the depth of PFAS contamination in groundwater to provide a complete CSM. And sampling depths will depend on the site and the study goals. For example, if drinking water wells are typically screened at a particular depth in your region, you may want to target similar depths during the characterization. It may also be important to note that the groundwater flow rate or direction can change with depth in certain aquifers. And then, as mentioned on the previous slide, this type of delineation would likely proceed in a phased approach and could rely on high-resolution site characterization or vertical profiling tools to assess the different depths. Next slide, please. Okay, so from a fate and transport perspective, the goal of your data evaluation is to understand which PFAS compounds are migrating, where they're migrating, how they're migrating, what controls that migration, and understand that the time scales that are involved with the process. Your data evaluation could include determining and defining the nature and extent of PFAS, then understanding how the extents may change over time. It may be beneficial to benchmark the mass flux of contaminants over time, and also that could aid in confirming the plume stability, but the evaluation of mass flux may not be appropriate or feasible at all sites. For your data evaluation, you can use some tools that are available, such as flow modeling, contaminant fate and transport modeling. There is a ModFlow USGT PFAS version that's designed to model PFAS. And I believe there's also an upcoming model called REMFLOOR MD that is designed to model PFAS as well in the saturated zone. Forensic evaluations can be useful to distinguish or understand the fractionation process and the differential transport time. Forensic methods can also help with precursor transformation and distinguishing unique sources. Some tools that could aid in that process range from simple to complex statistical methods, such as exploratory data analysis or principal component analysis. Then using illustrations such as the radar plots we discussed before, or doing pie chart versions of similar data or bar charts can also be helpful understanding the migration. Perhaps one of the most unique aspects to consider for the example scenario is the impact of the co-contaminant data, so the presence of that hydrocarbon in the NAPL. Data evaluation should really just seek to understand how the NAPL and the dissolved phase petroleum constituents affect your PFAS fate and transport. But now I'll pass it to Alex to discuss PFAS in surface water. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Well, now let's get back up to the surface and dive into surface water. So, if you look at looking at this slide, there's basically we have four different figures you're looking at here, and we're going to go around them, looking first at the air-water interface. So, if you remember, these are PFAS transport issues that we need to think about, consider when we're looking at surface water. So we're looking at surface water during ambient conditions, no stormwater runoff or rainfall occurring. So keep that in mind. So on the far upper left, we have the hydrophilic, hydrophobic aspects of the PFAS molecule all already discussed at length. Those actually play even more so in the surface water, as you'll see that the there'll be a tendency for PFAS to accumulate at that air-water interface. There's also, if you let's move over to the right of that, in general PFAS transport. So if you look closely, we'll get a little bit different into that. It's dissolved and stored PFAS in surface water and sediment. Looking below air-water interface, we see aerosolization, and then over to the far left. Excuse me, far right, we have PFAS-containing foam. So this is PFAS-containing foam. We're not discussing foam, AFFF directly. This is PFAS that happens to be causing foam to form. So we're going to look at those issues in our next three slides. So first, we're going to go through general PFAS transport. If you recall the earlier portion of training, as I said, we have hydrophobic and a hydrophilic head on tail and a hydrophilic head on the PFAS molecule, and this results in PFAS accumulating at the air, at the surface. If you look over at our figure, you'll see yellow circles. Those are going to be short chain PFAS. We have blue circles, which are long chain PFAS, and we have suspended particulate matter in the red. The yellow, the red, and the tan, those are suspended sediments, dissolved organic matter, things such as microplastics, that sort of thing. The PFAS molecules, as they, as they're moving through the through, through moving downstream, think of it that way. The molecules undergo absorption and desorption, deposition and resuspension in the process of moving that downstream, and all the while obeying various partition coefficients. Given the differences in short and long chain PFAS, as we've already discussed, we tend to have more long chain PFAS in the sorb phase onto those different particulates and in the sediment. And with the short chain PFAS near closer to the surface and in the dissolve phase. Now, this all has an impact on planning and sample collection, as you'll see in a little bit long, a little bit more in my presentation. So foam, as I said before, here we have PFAS has surfactant-like properties that make them have potential to form foam in surface water. Foam is formed in turbulence around rocks and due to wind and wave action. Here, as I said before, we're talking about PFAS in water, not foam, not AFFF itself. When foam forms, it removes PFAS from the water column and concentrates it into the foam. As you see, look at the figure on the far on the left hand, right hand side of the screen here. The concentration in the foam can be several orders of magnitude higher than in the underlying water column. This figure shows a cross section through the foam down to the stream bed, So the concentrations in the PFAS decrease in the downward direction. The highest concentrations in water are found in that little surface microlayer you see there. Pretty thin, so usually only like 50 microns thick. So obviously, it's going to be a little bit more challenging to sample that bit of water. The concentration, as we move down the Newston layer, which is a highly biological active zone, which is of interest to many things, including the critters that happen to live there, it's probably only 75 to 150 micrometers thick. And then below that, we have the water column, and concentration decrease as we go through the water column and then found in the sediments below. So this foam is transported downstream on the current and can be lifted into the air by wind and placed on land or elsewhere within the surface water, where it acts as another source of PFAS at those different locations. These foam islands eventually collapse and release the PFAS back into the water column or onto land if they happen to be there. With this high PFAS concentration, the foam is considered to be a risk to humans and ecological species via contact and ingestion. One of the recommendations found in the guidance documents issued by states such as Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin is to remove the foam when it's discovered and prevent it from being released back into the water or moved to a new location. Depending on the goals of your investigation, there are sampling methods developed to collect samples from the foam and the different layers seen here. In our guidance document, we have links to the sampling guidance from states such as Minnesota and Michigan, and others are provided in section 16.5 of that document. And here, and you look on the slide, that there's one example of that guidance that's available. Aerosolization. Oh, this is always an interesting topic, to me at least, is a process that has greater impact on ocean environments than on other surface waters due to the immense energy in wave and wind action and interaction with the shore. However, there's aerosolization occurring in other water bodies, such as in our case study, and that can also lead to foam formation that we have just discussed. What happens is that wind and wave action causes turbulence with air bubbles being forced below the water surface. As the bubbles rise to the surface, they scavenge PFAS and other molecules, such as salt, from the water column. Once the bubbles reach the surface, they either burst or there's sufficient amount of surfactant present, they form foam. The formation of foam is much more prevalent on the ocean shoreline than on inland water bodies due to large quantities of organic matter from decaying algae that have surfactant properties in themselves, and the waves meeting the shore with intensity causes that foam to more likely form. So there's a bit of caution here. Just because you see foam in the ocean or on any surface water, such as in our case study, it does not mean that PFAS are present. So we have a link. Interesting, there's a link at section 1.3.5.3 of the guidance document to a video showing that phenomenon of foam at an ocean that really is not, it's actually quite startling how much foam can be formed just from decomposition of organic matter that happens to be there. So to summarize, aerosolization is a process that removes PFAS from the water, places it into another medium, air or foam, providing another potential exposure route. Aerosolization has been the subject of in Antarctica, there's been several studies looking at aerosolization, and those studies found that aerosolization in the marine environment there can cause PFAS to be found several hundred kilometers inland. This is generally due to a lack of other significant PFAS sources in that kind of remote areas. Aerosolization can be the main source of PFAS exposure there. So let's go back to our case study. The training facility, as you see here, you've seen this slide before. It says, remember, we're focusing on non-stormwater runoff periods, so we're covering the stormwater as we cover stormwater-related impacts in our next module you'll see after I'm finished. The impact we are looking at is the discharge of PFAS plume in the groundwater to surface water. So only during non-stormwater runoff events, that's the only discharge from this training area to surface water. There is some ancillary discharge, potentially of windborne dust from the training area to the surface water, but that can be probably fairly minimal and easily controlled. The investigators in the training area should assess impacts on the surface water quality during these ambient periods and focus on protection of human and health and aquatic terrestrial invading species from adverse impact from PFAS through various routes of exposure. We don't cover those in this training, the health aspects here, but more of these impacts can be found in other sections or guidance doctrine, section 16.3, 7.1, and 7.2 of that document. We'll go into more detail on these various health impacts that we're talking about. So here we expanded, we blow up a little bit, see a larger area. And so where are we going to collect samples to help meet the site investigation goals for this case study? In this figure, we have, if you see, there's a legend on different types of samples in the far bottom left-hand corner. We have stars, which are surface water samples. We have pluses, which are sediment samples. And we have basically, I think of a red blob or the yellow outline. Those are going to be our foam samples. So if you look at the surface water samples first, as you see, we have two sets of three stars, one above. Since we're looking at the impacts from the training area, we have samples collected right above the area where the groundwater is being discharged to surface water. And then we have three stars farther down gradient that you see to look at, okay, what were the impacts from that mixing of that groundwater with surface water? Given the attributes of PFAS we just talked about, samples are located from several locations across the stream and depths through the water column. In that manner, we can establish an average concentration entering the concentration and positioning mass flux entering the area where the groundwater is mixing with surface water. So, in other words, at each one of those star locations, we're going to take samples at the air-water interface, because that's where we have PFAS located. We're going to take samples at several different depths within the water column, and then samples right above at the bottom. This is because the velocity, the other thing you want to collect is at every place you're taking a sample, you're going to get the stream velocity. So in that manner, as you saw with Matt's presentation in groundwater, we can look at what the mass flux of PFAS is before it gets to the groundwater discharge. And the reason we do that, we take different locations, is because there's different mixing going on, different PFAS attributes. And so the PFAS are located throughout the water column, but at different concentrations. So if you skip one of those different locations, then you're going to miss some of the mass that's occurring that's entering this area. Then we take the ones downstream, do the same thing we did upstream. And the downstream locations have to be prior to any other discharges of PFAS into the surface water body. So the three we see downstream, I've located them after a bend in a river, because the bend in the river will cause the river to mix better. But if there happens to be PFAS discharge from some other source entering, we need to move those three stars that you're seeing farther up and closer to just down gradient of where the groundwater enters. One of the things to consider when sampling is sampling high or low river flow. As river flow varies, the amount of dilution available changes. In addition, the amount of groundwater flow entering the receiving water can change with the surface height of the wa that water. So it's prudent to conduct sampling during each of these conditions. If foam is generated, here we show you the foam samples, then samples from the foam can be collected and consideration be made for removal of the foam to the extent feasible. So in doing that, you're going to reduce the potential of PFAS exposure and its relocation issues and exposure concentrations. Then you can either reduce or eliminate those. So we have sediment samples, and those are going to be collected at various points downstream, including probably where the PFAS enters the groundwater body, or excuse me, surface water body. The sediment can also act as a source sink of PFAS to the surface water due to resuspension and then deposition of sediments and absorption and desorption from those solids to that dissolve phase. We've included, if you look to the far right of the screen, We have a canal basically leaving the surface water to take water for agricultural purposes, and we have one to take it upstream to some community for their water supply. So we have sample points at the intakes from to those two canals to help evaluate potential issues that might be needed to be handled before that water gets used in their various locations. Ta, we get to a check-in for our knowledge check. So if you guys should be able to remember, this should be a fairly easy one for you if you've been paying attention at all. So on a surface water with PFAS-containing foam, where are the highest concentrations of PFAS found? A, the surface microlayer, B, the foam, C, the Neuston layer, or D, the deeper water column. So you can put those answers and answer quick on the answer you think is the best. I have faith in you guys. Ah, surface microlayer, foam, 61%. Very good. You guys did do a pretty good job. Surface microlayer will be the second most highest concentration, but the highest concentration that is found in the surface water itself. So there's one thing I forgot to mention to you guys. You remember remember the water column figure showing PFAS being absorbed to various particulate matter? So this can be a significant portion of the PFAS and needs to be accounted for in that mass flux calculation. So this relates to the actually sampling analysis. So when they do the analysis, you need to analyze the solids that are filtered out of the water sample prior to measuring PFAS in water. So the solids they filtered out, they filtered out before they run the sample through their apparatus because you don't want to have that being, clogging it up. So this is important to make sure that you actually get your mass flux concentrations analyzed and done correctly. So this is even more important in stormwater, which is coming to you next, and when I turn it over to Matt to cover stormwater.
All right, thank you, Alex. Yeah, next we're moving on to PFAS fate and transport in stormwater. So we'll go to the next slide. So the considerations discussed for surface water generally also apply for stormwater conditions. PFAS have a preference for interfacial areas. They're going to have the potential to form foam and for aerosolization. And the presence of suspended solids and dissolved organic matter may also impact PFAS fate and transport. Stormwater also has some unique aspects to consider, in addition to what you might consider for surface water. Namely, the inherent variability. PFAS or precipitation is going to vary in intensity, frequency, and duration. And this variation is going to occur both at the site level and also regionally. So each area is going to have its own unique hydrologic conditions that should be considered when you're looking at PFAS fate and transport by the groundwater pathway, or sorry, stormwater pathway. Investigating PFAS in stormwater needs to consider how runoff occurs, where it's going to occur, and when it occurs, and where it goes. This will vary from site to site and will be tied to the infrastructure, stormwater management practices, the topography, and the ground cover. We also need to think about how the runoff that is generated may impact receiving waters and the potential receptors along the way. When considering the role of stormwater for PFAS fate and transport, it's essential to consider the potential sources. So first, we have to think about the atmospheric sources, which may be from off-site locations, carried short or long distances, or it may be related to site-related emissions. There also need to consider site-related sources and site-related sinks or storage areas where PFAS may be absorbed and then later released. For example, concrete or asphalt may act as residual sources where they store PFAS that have been released, and over time they can store the PFAS and slowly release it during each storm event. The same may be true for some soils that are impacted by PFAS, and same for stormwater infrastructure across the facility. Let's see, let's go to the next slide, please. So there are several things that need to be considered when developing your sampling plan for stormwater. First, stormwater runoff may contain suspended solids, dissolved organic matter, and PFAS may absorb to both of those. So it's something to consider. The sampling plan should consider evaluating both dissolved PFAS concentrations and potentially the concentrations that are absorbed to the turbidity in the samples. Another important thing to consider for your sampling plan is the first flush phenomenon, wherein this refers to the period between storm events when pollutants may accumulate at the surface. So when some time passes between precipitation events, when the precipitation does occur, the runoff may carry all the accumulated pollutants. This can create scenarios where concentrations during that initial period may be higher in the initial volume of runoff compared to concentrations present later in the storm event. And the importance of this first flush will vary from site to site, but it's important that the site's characterized to understand how PFAS mass is going to be transported during the runoff events over time. The flow of runoff will vary across the site. Increased velocity is going to increase the transport distance within a given time, so that's important for mass transport calculations. Increased velocity may also lead to increased turbulence, which is going to increase the amount of mixing that's occurring and also increase the chance for foam formation. So your sampling plan should consider these issues. Some additional considerations to consider: the relationship between concentration and mass flux. So by this I mean it's important to consider both the concentrations that you're observing and also the discharge rate in terms of volume per time. Combining both gives you a sense of what's being moved through the environment. For locations with higher turbidity, it may be helpful to analyze the solids portion of the sample as well as the dissolve phase. Sampling plans should evaluate sites for locations where foam may be formed and target those, and also consider where more or less turbulence may be occurring to see how well mixed the samples are. You also want to target where suspected sources are and make sure your sampling is representative of the areas that you would like it to be representative of. Lastly, it's essential to evaluate PFAS concentrations in rain. So you really have to understand what the fundamental inputs are, when in your stormwater, what concentrations are present in the rainfall before it becomes runoff, and how may those concentrations vary over time. Next slide, please. So this figure presents the potential sampling locations to evaluate PFAS transport at the site through the stormwater. We've included locations that would monitor the ambient rainfall. We've included locations in the receiving water, the stream, both upstream of where the site discharge would occur, and also downstream of the site where the mixes with the stream, so assessing PFAS concentrations at both. And then we've also included sampling locations, the intake locations for downstream users. Within the site, we're targeting locations along the flow path from the source area to the receiving waters, and also looking at locations where foaming may occur. At each sample location, including the streams, it's important to measure the discharge of the location so that you can assess the mass that's moving through the system as well as the concentration. Aside from the sampling locations, it's important to collect data under various conditions. For instance, we might recommend collecting samples during the first flush period as well as during later portions of the storm event. It could be beneficial to compare concentrations that you're getting from grab samples as well as both time-weighted composite samples or flow-weighted composite samples. So you can average out your concentrations, every hour collecting samples, or you could determine how to average out samples but based on flow. So if the rainfall intensity varies throughout a storm, you may want to target equal volumes of water rather than just random times. Of note, each terrain event's going to be unique in terms of its intensity and duration, so that just underscores the importance of measuring both the concentration and discharge. Lastly, it's important to evaluate potential changes across multiple seasons to see both how your rainfall is going to change and how concentrations in your stormwater will change. Next slide, please. So, data evaluation should strive to understand how stormwater may or may not transport PFAS and to understand what factors are affecting the fate and transport. Some key considerations include evaluating the concentration and the mass loading, combining the concentrations with the stormwater discharge rate. This considers whether concentrations or mass are more important to the project objectives. So, for example, exposure risk may be more tied to concentrations, but fate and transport concerns may be more tied to the mass transport. That's going to vary by project and potentially phases of the project. Your data evaluation should seek to understand the role of the first flush at the site and understand how concentrations during initial portions of the storm compare to concentrations at the end of the storm, and then taking a look at how this data may help you understand the transport of PFAS from source areas to receptors. This type of line of questioning should also consider how mass migration varies during the storm. So, for example, it may be possible that low concentrations during high discharge period actually convey more PFAS mass than high concentrations during low discharge periods. So it's important to understand that relationship. Next, the data evaluation should also consider seasonal fluctuations in stormwater and stormwater concentrations and how that would relate back to fate transport. And then lastly, and perhaps most importantly, the investigation needs to figure out where PFAS concentrations are coming from and figuring out can we tie the concentrations to a specific area or specific source, such as our concrete and asphalt as acting as long-term sources, like so in the source release area, are those areas contributing PFAS or contaminated soils contributing to the stormwater concentrations? What are the ambient concentrations in the rain? And what are the impacts of turbidity? So, answering these questions are essential to understanding fate and transport of PFAS in stormwater at a site. And from there, we'll move on to Lee, where he will discuss some considerations for PFAS remediation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Matt. So next, I'm going to talk about why and how we should consider all these PFAS fate and transport behaviors and the characteristics that when we're doing PFAS treatment and soil and groundwater remediation. Okay, so let's talk about soil first. So here on slide 52, you can see the cross-section of our hypothetical HOPF site in today's training. So for treatment of PFAS contaminated soil at a HOPF release site like this, we're typically talking about the source zone, the source area vet zone soil that has relatively high PFAS concentrations, but with a relatively small or limited volume. And we need to understand the PFAS source strengths in soil, such as the total PFAS mass and the mass of the PFAS precursors. We need to understand the PFAS composition. This includes both the regulated and the non-regulated PFAS chemicals, and also includes the precursors. And we also need to know how the PFAS chemicals partition on soil particles and distribute in different phases. We need to understand all these fate and transport behavior to support the remedy selection. For example, how do we want to treat the soil? Is it feasible to treat it in situ or ex situ with a certain method such as a thermal treatment or stabilization? We also need this information to evaluate the potential impact of the selected remedy and determine whether and how all the regulated and also unregulated PFAS chemicals can be effectively addressed. particularly for those unregulated PFAS, they are unregulated today, does not necessarily mean they will not become regulated in the future. So we need to consider whether the selective remedy can also address any of those unregulated PFAS chemicals. So we don't have to worry about them, or at least be less worried about the future regulation changes. We need to consider whether any of these unregulated PFAS chemicals, such as the precursors, could be transformed to the regulated ones during the treatment. In other words, we need to consider if and how we can somehow future-proof our remedy to a certain extent to make it more resilient to potential future changes. If we select a destruction type of technology to treat the soil, such as incineration or thermal desorption, we need all this information so we can properly evaluate the mass balance and the generation of products of incomplete destruction during the treatment process to determine whether or not, whether and to what extent we have achieved complete mineralization of PFAS. If we select sorption or stabilization or soil washing, we need all this information to determine what chemical amendment or reagent to use and estimate how many pounds or gallons of the chemicals are needed for the treatment. So we also need to evaluate the long-term performance if we choose the sorption or stabilization method. If we decide to leave the treated soil in place or put the treated or even untreated soil in the landfill, in these cases, we need to know how the PFAS chemicals interact with other contaminants that are also present at the site, how precursors transformation is occurring at the site soil, and how much PFAS is or may be leaching out from the untreated or treated soil. Okay, so for groundwater at a FFF release site, similarly, we have a relatively limited extent of high PFAS concentration groundwater in the source area. We would also have a groundwater plume with relatively lower concentrations, but extends to a larger area. So for selection and design of a groundwater remedy, we would want to know what is in the source? What is that is what kind of PFAS chemicals we're dealing with? This includes not only the typical targeted compounds, 40 compounds in method 16-3A, and the few ones with regulatory standards, but also those that do not have regulations, those not targeted by the standard method. Especially the precursors. We need to know if there are any co-contaminants in the groundwater. We would also want to know the PFAS source strengths, the concentrations, the total PFAS mass. It's not just the ones with regulatory levels and can be detected by the targeted method. We would also want to know whether the PFAS source may change over time. That is, how much PFAS is leaching from the bed zone. Does it change over time? How long will the leaching last, etc.? Whether there is any precursor transformation under the site-specific conditions over time. We need all this information to inform the remedy selection and the long-term performance evaluation for a groundwater remedy. And if we decide to use a pump and treat approach to get the contaminated groundwater out for ex situ treatment, assuming we can, which is another complicated problem depending on the site-specific conditions that we will not discuss today. And most commonly, we may choose to use sorption media such as granular activated carbon or ion exchange resins to treat the groundwater. We need to know the PFAS composition, co-contaminants, total and individual PFAS concentration, etc., to determine which type of sorption media to use, what kind of pretreatment may be needed, and how to design the treatment system. In most cases, it's not just a few PFAS chemicals with regulatory level that you need to treat or consider in your design. Many other PFAS chemicals and co-contaminants may compete for the limited sorption sites on the sorption media. If you're interested, you can check the newly published sorption-based technology guidance in the updated ITRC PFAS guidance for more details. If we are somehow modifying a existing treatment system, such as adding a granular activated carbon unit, so we can also treat PFAS in addition to the contaminants that the system was originally designed to treat. We also need to consider whether any of the existing treatment steps may unintentionally change the composition and concentration of PFAS chemicals that we want to treat. For example, if you have a lot of precursors in your water, and if you also already have some kind of advanced oxidation unit, such as using UV hydrogen peroxide to treat 1,4-dioxane, this unit may unintentionally convert some or potentially all of your precursors to the regulated PFAS chemicals. So if you haven't considered this in your design, the GAC unit you added to your system may turn out to have a smaller capacity than you have expected, and you may have an earlier breakthrough and a need to change the sorption media more frequently. If we somehow decide to adopt an in situ approach to either use chloroactive carbon for in situ sorption or to consider the evaluation of monitored attenuation, natural attenuation potential for long-term plume management, we also need all this fed and transport information to really understand the source and the plume longevity so we can properly design and evaluate a in situ type of remedy or approach. Okay, so for groundwater, we also need to understand how different PFAS chemicals partition and distribute in different phases in the subsurface. Whether there is matrix diffusion at a particular site, depending on your site-specific condition, and whether there is any colloidal facilitated transport, etc., in order to really understand the PFAS plume you're dealing with, and so we can evaluate whether it is feasible to apply a pump-and-treat approach or an in-situ approach. And also to evaluate how the plume migrates and evolves over time, what kind of mass flux we're dealing with, and how long the plume may last, and how much time we need to somehow clean up the plume with different technologies and approaches. And that's all I have. I'm going to hand this back to the moderator.
All right, thank you, Lee. And thank you to all of our trainers for getting us through the training today. This is just a quick reminder of all the PFAS trainings that are offered by ITRC, our intro and chemistry explained training, as well as the PFAS and biosolids training were all hosted earlier this year. They are all archived and available on the CLUIN website. And then the absorption-based training will be held live in a couple of weeks. So go ahead and go over to the CLUIN page if you're interested in viewing any of those or signing up for future trainings. All right, and so we've now reached our final Q&A of the training, and I do have a couple of questions for each of our trainers from the final section of our training. And I will first start with Matt to talk about the saturated zone. What are some of the factors that impact PFAS migration in groundwater and create differential migration?
Sure, yeah, thank you, Taylor. Some things to consider are the aquifer geochemistry, your pH, your ORP, redox conditions, things like that. You also want to look at the presence of co-contaminants. You want to look at precursor transformation and also sorption to the aquifer matrix. All of those can lead to differential migration.
Thank you. And one more question. For the data evaluation in the saturated zone, radial diagrams are used as examples. What data are plotted in those diagrams?
All right, yeah. So the radar diagrams and similar depictions, such as pie charts or bar charts, generally show the relative percent concentration of selected PFAS compounds. So the key here is that the relative percent concentration is based on the concentration of a specific PFAS compound relative to the total PFAS concentration in a sample. And that calculation may or may not factor in molecular mass of the individual compounds, but it's a relative percent of the total. Specific compounds that are shown on those diagrams should be selected based on some preliminary exploratory data analysis to determine what optimal compounds should be used for the different axes. And that'll be based on the project objectives and the data set. So, for example, you may select different compounds if you're trying to distinguish between two different PFAS sources, or you may choose different compounds if you're just trying to evaluate migration of a single source. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Matt. I now have a question for Alex, on surface water. For surface water sampling, can you describe what sampling depths in the surface water should be considered?
Sure. So this all goes back to those PFAS attributes we're talking about. So you're going to see you're going to have to sample at the surface of the water to make sure you get those PFAS or that have accumulated there. You have to sample at the bottom of the water column, right above the sediment, and then you need to sample depending on depth, 2 or 3 or 4, depending on how deep the water body is, locations. In the water column, between the surface water and the sediment.
All right, thank you, Alex. All right, Matt, I'm coming back at you with another question on the stormwater section. Can you describe some of the factors to consider for sampling stormwater?
Sure. So, vital consideration is knowing the PFAS concentration in the precipitation itself. So, not just your runoff. Think about the initial precipitation and knowing the concentrations there, knowing that they may change over time. I think the other things to really think about are understanding the area that's represented by a sample. So it's essential to know the drainage area contributing to your sample locations. And then from there, you can evaluate whether the potential sources that you're trying to evaluate are contributing to your concentrations. Other things to think about are the importance of the first flush, the effect of turbidity or dissolved organic matter, the potential for foaming, and then also the evaluation to compare both concentration and mass discharge. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Matt. And then finally, Lee, just a couple questions. For source area groundwater treatment, what are some of the treatment methods that are considered widely used?
Yeah, sure. So for source area groundwater, we can, if we can, we can pump it out for ex situ treatment using granular activated carbon, ion exchange resins, or foam fractionation, or we can try to inject colloidal activated carbon for in situ sorption, in which case a higher dosage of the colloidal activated carbon may be needed compared to the treatment of the downgraded plume that typically has a lower concentration of PFAS.
Great, thanks, Lee. One final question before I wrap it up. For source area soils, what are some of the treatment methods for PFAS that are considered widely used?
So for soil in the source area, we can try to dig it out for ex situ treatment using destructive technologies such as thermal or incineration, or we can try to do soil washing or sorption stabilization. We can also try to do it in situ with thermal desorption or sorption and stabilization.
All right, thank you, Lee. And thank you to all of our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would like to hear back from you, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. I'm also going to drop it in the chat now. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thanks again to everyone who joined today, and thanks again to our trainers and subject matter experts for being here.